Taliban proposed a 3-month ceasefire with the Afghan government in return for the release of 7,000 militant prisoners. Lebanon's Prime Minister designate Saad al-Hariri says that he's quit the task of forming a new government after failing to reach an agreement with President Ouma. The Israeli military warns that Hezbollah can fire up to 3,000 missiles every day at the occupied Palestinian territories in case of a war with Lebanon. This is World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Starting with Afghanistan, the Taliban proposing a 3-month ceasefire in return for the release of some 7,000 of their members held in jails. The militant group also wanted the names of its leaders to be removed from a UN blacklist. An Afghan government negotiator involved in peace talks has called it a big demand. Now, this as the militants have stepped up attacks on cities and villages, taking a swathe of territory under control since May. They've also captured several border crossings, including with Pakistan, Iran, and Turkmenistan. The Afghan military has launched offensives to retake those areas. Dozens of Taliban militants have been reportedly killed. Amin Alami says that Afghan officials and pundits are not much optimistic about the Taliban's truce proposal. They doubt if the group is really ready for lasting peace.
As we look to the recent remarks and words of the Afghan government officials here, they are not much optimistic about the real will of the Taliban in order to say yes to peace in Afghanistan. For instance, I talked to a university professor regarding to this issue just a few hours ago. He said that given the Taliban militants have captured a large number of districts all over Afghanistan, having a 3-month opportunity is the best option for them to have full control over those districts, and secondly, recruit more militants in order to strengthen their military front or armed front. On the other hand, many others also believe that given the Afghan government recently released 5,000 Taliban militants from Afghan jails, but instead some of them returned back to the battlefields, and in many cases Afghan forces killed a high number of those Taliban who had returned to the battlefields. They argue and urge the Afghan government to not trust the Taliban in this particular issue unless it receives international assurances in this regard.
Shifting to Lebanon, the Prime Minister designate Saad al-Hariri there gives up on the formation of a new government, citing differences with the president. Hariri made the announcement after consultations with President Michel Aoun, who had asked him for fundamental adjustments in the proposed cabinet. He said it was clear that the two could not come to a consensus. And this marks another setback to Beirut's efforts to end almost 9 months of political deadlock amid an economic crisis. Lebanon is facing what the World Bank is calling one of the world's worst economic crises in modern history. The country has been without a formal government since the deadly explosion in Beirut last August. Maryam Saleh says that observers had a notion that Hariri did not want to form a cabinet in consensus with the Lebanese president.
But many were hoping that after 9 months, we would actually see the birth of this cabinet finally. However, what we heard today from Hariri was not surprising to many observers who knew what was happening behind closed doors. They had a notion that Hariri did not want to form a cabinet in consensus with President Michel Aoun himself specifically. And so this is just one of the reasons. This is in addition to so many other issues that were in stake. I mean, Hariri understands the gravity of the situation, the president as well. The president has said that he was very positive just recently, but he also said that this list that he was given just yesterday does not live up or realize all the things that they had agreed on before. There was agreements before, there were common denominators that were being put, and then we had more problems put aside, despite the initiative by the Speaker Nabih Habibi, and he tried to intervene with, of course, a demand by Hezbollah calling on the the speaker to try to be a mediator between the two and try to let Hariri become more flexible when it came to the number of ministers and so on, but still adding more numbers of ministers to make them 24, to have better representation of all the sects was not enough, it seems. There is another issue that plays out. We have continuous foreign intervention.
The Israeli military says that Hezbollah can fire up to 3,000 missiles every day toward the occupied Palestinian territories in case of a war with Lebanon. Tel Aviv said the Lebanese resistance movement can maintain the barrage for at least a week. The military estimated that Hezbollah has 130,000 to 150,000 rockets and missiles in its arsenal, many of them capable of hitting targets deep within Israel. In May, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas fired thousands of rockets at Israel during a war that lasted 11 days. Some of those rockets reached as far as Tel Aviv and even Haifa to the north. Israeli new prime minister has relaunched a controversial project for the construction of 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The so-called E1 involves the construction at an unbuilt area that cuts land access between Palestinian inhabited territories, rendering any future unified Palestinian state unviable. Former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also tried to advance that project, but it was halted under pressure from the international community, the Palestinians, and rights groups. The project is also expected to draw objections from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's left-wing coalition partners and the U.S. All of those Israeli settlements on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Mona Kendall has some updates and details on the new Israeli settlement project in the occupied West Bank.
Those 3,412 new settler units would be built in the occupied West Bank, mainly in one of the biggest Israeli settlements known as Ma'ale Adumim. These settlements are part of the E1 project that would be linking some West Bank cities with East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, allowing settlers to move freely from the Ma'ale Adumim settlement and the settlements around it to inside Jerusalem, Al-Quds, however, separating Palestinian villages and towns and cities. It would be separating the central of the occupied West Bank from northern the occupied West Bank. And this, of course, would be very difficult for the Palestinians. According to experts and anti-settlement groups, what we have read this morning, that this might lead to a new conflict or a possible conflict between the American administration and the Israeli regime, because it seems that the U.S. administration is trying to convince the Israelis not to declare about major settlement projects that would be bringing some problems, whether to the Israeli regime and to the Israeli Prime Minister Bennett himself.
The Israeli military says it has arrested some 30 Palestinian students after they visited the house of a Hamas prisoner, which the regime demolished last week. The military has accused the students of being terror operatives. It claims they transferred money for the Hamas resistance movement in organized activities in Judea and Samaria. The students are from Beresheit University in the occupied West Bank. The university has condemned the detention, calling it a violation of all international laws and norms that guarantee students' right to freedom of movement. It also called on the international community to intervene immediately to secure their release. Hamas has described the Israeli move as a miserable attempt to harm the spirit of resistance among Palestinians and their support for the families of prisoners, martyrs, and wounded. A UK-based NGO has revealed Britain's arms delivered to Saudi Arabia has been three times more than it was previously announced. In our News Review program, my colleague has discussed that issue with our guests.
In this edition of the program, Britain has reportedly exported around three times the amount of weaponry and military equipment to Saudi Arabia than it previously announced. A recent investigation by Campaign Against Arms Trade shows British officials have used a loophole in the country's so-called transparent export controls. The report says the move intends to hide the real extent of the UK's contribution to the Saudi aggression against Yemen, while authorities claim British ministers signed off £6.7 billion worth of arms sales. The probe says the true figure is likely to be closer to £20 billion. Meanwhile, the UK's Department for International Trade, which approves all arms exports, has not disputed the findings of the study. Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives since then. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Saeed Purozoz joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers, who's joining us from Hasselt. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Saeed, let's start off with you. It's great to see you. Let's talk about the contribution that Britain is making to the aggression against Yemen. Why has it increased threefold now? There are talks of a loophole in the investigation by the Campaign Against Armed Trade says that British officials have used a loophole in the so-called transparent export controls. What's really going on here?
Great to be with you, Bardia. We'll get to the why in a little bit, but let's have a look at that loophole and how they did it. As you said earlier, there are two ways that the British government is operating in this manner. The first way is they have a standard licenses system. They publish the arms that they are selling to whatever that country is, who they are selling it to. They're completely transparent as far as that is concerned, hence that £6.7 billion pounds worth of weapons. But what they're not telling people is the rest of the money and the rest of the arms that they've been selling to Saudi Arabia and probably other autocratic regimes. There is a parallel, opaque, or less transparent system called the Open License System. And as the name suggests, really, there is no limit. There is no monetary limit. Arms manufacturers can sell however amount of weaponry to, in this case, Saudi Arabia and many other countries. Between, I think, 2011 and 2019, they sold billions of pounds worth of weapons to 53 countries. Two-thirds of those countries are known to have really not a great record as far as human rights.
Brecht Jonkers in Hasselt. Mr. Jonkers, give us your thoughts on the investigation by the Campaign Against Arms Trade. Three times more weapons will most likely lead to X times more deaths. Why is this happening?
Well, we have to always bear in mind that when we're talking about the war against Yemen, which is often called and correctly, of course, in a way, called the Saudi-led coalition or the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen. But we have to bear in mind when we talk about this that it is not just Saudi Arabia that is at the helm. In fact, when you see on the ground, Saudi Arabia itself has very little control sometimes over these various militias and terrorist groups that they are harnessing there to fight against the National Salvation Government of Yemen. And Saudi-backed groups are often in conflict against Emirati-backed groups, which are, in theory, also, of course, part of the Saudi-led coalition. But what I would like to focus on, of course, is the wider perspective. It's not merely a Saudi-led coalition. Of course, the Saudis have taken it upon themselves to lead this coalition, this invasion on the ground. But in reality, this Saudi war is also a British war, is also an American war. It's, for an extent, also a French war, and is definitely an Israeli, a Zionist war. So all these countries, these major powers, have often banded together ever since 2015 to try to subdue this what they saw as a threat rising up in Yemen under the National Salvation Government after the revolution of September the 21st, 2014, which, of course, they have covered up by calling it an Iranian-backed Shia rebel group, which it isn't. It's an organization, Ansar Allah, or the Houthis, especially, are an organization that have been around for decades and have been showing themselves as a very indigenous and a very Yemeni revolutionary organization. But now when you see this, these new revelations, as sad as it may be, it is definitely not surprising We have seen over the past 6 years, nearly almost 7 years now, the constant coming to light of reports on Western powers, and especially recently European powers, that have been trying to circumvent their humanitarian duties and their adherence to international law, of course, by selling weapons to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, specifically with the knowledge that these weapons will be used against Yemen. I know for a fact that it has taken several years for my own country of Belgium to finally relent and decide to stop exports to Saudi Arabia. The same thing has happened, fortunately, as well in Germany, and especially in Italy, which has taken one of the strongest stances against the UAE and Saudi Arabia in all of Europe. But unfortunately, the major, real big players in terms of arms export to Saudi Arabia have not or barely done anything to stop this. And then I'm talking, of course, about the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and also Canada, which have kept on sending weapons, have kept on finding loopholes. In many ways, that's why these corporations, especially the ones that have like systems or technology or something in their name, in many ways, what they do is they sell technological systems that are not always necessarily a single appliance, let's say, which means that they can theoretically also be used for non-military means. And that way, these countries, these Western countries and these Western corporations, cover themselves up by saying the only thing we're doing is selling technology to Riyadh and to Abu Dhabi. Of course, they know full well that this technology, in many cases, this is things that can be used as targeting software or other equipment that can be used for the high-end, high-tech weaponry and weapon system that Saudi Arabia uses in its war against Yemen.
All right, let's leave it there. Historian and journalist Brett Yonker is joining us from Hasselt. Also, thanks to Saeed Pourreza speaking to us from the British capital, London. With it, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the Newsroom.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, freedom of thought in Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Islam and freedom of thought. The freedom of thought in Islam is not recently emerged. In fact, it was practiced and implemented since the birth of Islam. Islam encourages freedom of thought and denounced oppression and compulsion. It refers to the right of the person to think and to express his own thought. The world we live in, it contains societies with all kinds of beliefs. Muslims living in such a world must be respectful towards all beliefs they come up against, no matter what they may be, and behave forgivingly, justly, and humanely. This responsibility placed on believers is to invite people to the beauty of the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by means of peace and compassion. Islam is a religion which provides and guarantees freedom of ideas, thought, and life. It has issued commands to prevent and forbid tensions, disputes, slander, and even negative thinking among people. In the same way that it is definitely opposed to terrorism and all acts of violence, it has also forbidden even the slightest ideological pressure to be put on them. Sometimes, you know, this whole concept of freedom of expression and freedom of thought, it is taken to an extreme where there are no limits to it. We're not proposing that. And there are other times when the other extreme comes into the picture and comes into the play, and that is that you're not allowed to express your ideas and your thoughts. Both of these extremes are condemned by Islam. Islam gives that plain field to everyone to be able to intellectually present their thoughts and ideas. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about freedom of thought in Islam. Forcing people to believe in a religion or to adopt its forms of belief is completely contrary to the essence and spirit of Islam. That is because, according to Islam, true faith is only possible with free will and freedom of conscience. As we see in Quran, chapter Al-Kafirun, verse number 6, Allah says, "To you your religion and to me mine." So He is teaching the believers that this is how you're supposed to act in the society you live in. A model of society in which people are forced to worship is completely contradictory to Islam. Belief and worship are only of any value when they are directed to Allah by the free will of the individual. If a system imposes belief and worship on people, then they will become religious out of fear of that system. And this is not what Islam expects us to accomplish. From the religious point of view, what really counts is that religion should be lived for Allah's good pleasure in an environment where people's consciences are totally free. Yes, there are cases where you see that somebody tries to disturb the peace of the society, tries to disturb the intellectual peace of the society, and tries to disturb that ideal Islamic environment, that person needs to be stopped. And we should all agree on having a tranquil and peaceful society in which humanity can nourish and flourish. But generally speaking, Islam does not expect the religion to be shoved down people's throats. It never has, neither in the past nor today, alhamdulillah. So freedom of thought has its own and very special place in Islam. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing The House on Cocoa Road, directed by Damani Baker. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Telegraph, The Guardian, and many others. And alongside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, The House on Cocoa Road is the story of director Damani Baker's family, particularly about his mother's story, Fanny Houghton, who moved her children from Oakland, California, to participate in the Granada Revolution, only to find her family in harm's way of a US military invasion. This film also sheds light on the history of black power movements and their struggle for racial equality.
I call the United States home, but this country has a painful legacy of violence that we still struggle to confront.
I think we always have to find something that holds a promise, and that way we look toward the future.
You're committed to humanity, to making the world a better place. You know, not just for your family, but everybody's family. We were trying to make sense of this world.
One of the most important things that has to be done in the process of carrying out a revolutionary struggle is to merge the personal with the political, where they're no longer separate.
You have this situation where we are trying to build a new society.
Grenada is the southernmost of the Windward Islands in the West Indies.
Here's our revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was a utopia.
And the next thing I knew, she was packing you all up.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy.
I took my young children out of my country to come here to help this country. I left in pain. This is the first time I've been back, so you've got to be very sensitive. I remember you asking me, as the bombs dropped and the island shook, you said this must be what they call war.
There is a freedom tide rising in our hemisphere. The spirit of democracy is assuming its rightful role as the great unifier of the people.
The shooting! The shooting!
My mother always said that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And if we work towards change, conditions will become different.
Long live peace in our Americas and in the world, forward ever, backward never.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for joining the show. Now, this documentary gives you an insightful and historical look at race relations in the US and also offers an alternative look at the US-led invasion of Grenada, but from a black perspective. And Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this film?
I think it's a very strong film. It's a very engaging film. I think what it does particularly well, there's a clip very early on where Angela Davis, the great black activist, is saying, we need to make the personal political. And this is exactly what this film does. It starts with this opening montage of footage from various tapes that Damani Baker, the director, has found in, I think, the garage of his mother when he was moving her house. She was moving house. Yeah, and you know, so you've got footage from, you know, 83, 99, 2015, all spliced together. And you get a sense of a young man, young filmmaker, piecing these disparate frames and images together, trying to work out what they represent. But it does so in a way that's incredibly casual. It doesn't feel like a serious history lesson. It feels like you've been invited over to someone's house on a Sunday morning. They're telling you about their family history over coffee and cake. It's sort of deceptively casual, but it does build to a much bigger picture of American life and black American life in particular.
And Lee, if I could turn to you now, why is it important to revisit these topics? And you see like a trove of sort of documentaries coming out about black power movements, and we've covered quite a few on this show with the Black Panther Party and so forth. What relevance does it have today?
Yeah, it's great relevance. And I think when you look at the historical film that we have, particularly with films like this, it's surprising how much contemporary resonance it has with the situation of African-American communities today in America. But it also speaks, I think, that film to a broader narrative. And it's this perpetual search within the African diaspora for that home, that place, that belonging. And wherever it is, from wherever our particular roots are, we have a deep need to be reconnected. And I think that what you're looking at is African Americans seeking to escape the predations of Jim Crow, you know, racism and its legacies in America. Going to Grenada, and then finding themselves at the end of an imperialist gun. And I thought that was a powerful narrative. You've sought to escape racism, but actually you've ended up in a place where American imperialism has rolled up on the Grenadian shores with devastating consequences. And I also think the narrative about black women's leadership role in having to make decisions about their family, where they live, what quality of life they will like. Those are the kind of conversations that I think are, you know, very deep within black communities of, can we survive here? Will we prosper here? Will our children be treated equally? So
that is a very important point to make, and this documentary certainly raises all those issues. It's also a very political film, as you alluded to also. I just want to talk a little bit now about the politics of the film before we move on. So on the one hand, Mike, the official US narrative of the invasion of Grenada was that Grenada's government was working with so-called communist Cuba and wanted to make the base there. And Ronald Reagan, the president at the time, quote, said it was necessary to bring the spirit of freedom and to Grenada in the form of a military strike. But of course, this documentary goes against this narrative, doesn't it, and offers a different perspective.
It does. I think it, what it succeeds in doing is presenting this counterpoint, because Damani Baker realizes that when the family moves away from Grenada, goes back to the USA, the image that he sees of Grenada in American media is very different from the image that he saw growing up. And, you know, you're getting the sense that American news media presented Ronald Reagan as this great liberator. He went into Grenada and sorted the situation out, and all of a sudden it's much better for him doing that. And actually, Damani Baker, what he's done by making this film and piecing all these individual pieces of footage together that have been taken over the decades, what he's done is he's actually presented a very convincing counter-image to that claim, and the counter-image to what was the dominant image in American media at the time.
Mm. And I did a bit of more research actually on this topic, because I found it really interesting in the way this documentary brought it up. And it was reported that a senior British officer who watched the Grenada invasion from Barbados, Major Mark Adkin, he wrote afterward, quote, that it was launched because of the intense desire of the president and his advisors to raise U.S. prestige, particularly at home and in the armed forces, where morale and self-respect had fallen substantially since the Vietnam War. Lee, do you think that this was the real reason then behind the invasion?
Well, yeah, there's nothing like crushing a little country to, reinforce one's flagging self-esteem. So that's a narrative we've seen in world politics. But I also think that the you've got to remember that, you know, with Norman Manley in Jamaica at the time, that there was a very much sense that there might be a domino effect in relation to socialism, communism in the region.
The US perceived this as a threat?
The US perceived this as a very real threat that could see a swathe of Caribbean islands really moving to the left. Not far from their coast. And so a combination of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the region.
Hello, my name is Damani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story. Her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So that was Damani Baker there himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Damani's personal life. What do you make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Damani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, you know, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was Great Migration, then civil rights, you know, the advances in civil rights. And he's trying to piece out where he falls and how come that he, as a young filmmaker, you know, has the time, the leisure time and the money to go around the world making movies and you know.
Even the title of the film, The House on Cocoa Road, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot, if you like, a sort of straight line. You know, how do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us? And given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles, you know, how do we get through all that to get to where we are today? And you know, the archive footage is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. So I think it speaks to that broader narrative. And within that, there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for its own identity, its own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me, actually, of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother.
Yeah.
What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that, actually, the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Granada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also, if the film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I think that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
I'd like to ask Sister Angela to make a few brief introductory remarks.
I'm here in pre-Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful militant revolution.
My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the, not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government. A revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
There's legendary activist Angela Davis, world-renowned scholar and activist and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Granada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people. And Maurice Bishop, the prime minister at the time, he was tragically later shot dead, said, if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of this, a strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had, coming out of the Vietnam War, were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing the horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. And I think they began to fundamentally reassess, or at least some did, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they looked elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing and sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader Marcus Garvey to build Black Nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated for very many Black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see Black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world, responded to that call.
That's very revealing indeed. I don't think many people know about this aspect of Grenada from the Black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? How was life painted for Black people in Grenada, the reality of it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and, you know, go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration. And you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful.
Resonates a lot with today, of course.
I think so. And, you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
They're not naming any names.
Not naming any names, no.
We'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy, it was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's a discussion now where that came from. Entire Black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night.
It was very disappointing to see all the work that we've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the Black community anywhere in the States.
That was not an environment to raise children. A little bit more of Angela Davis then. We talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny Damani Baker's mother was a student of hers at the UCLA, yes, and later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life, and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fanny's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life for racial equality. What does she mean for Black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for Black activists worldwide, continues to be an inspiration today for the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement, and wider. African women on the continent, still revere Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world. And quite rightly so, when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking a loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline, and she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time in the 80s organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
Well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realize just how far we've got to come. People have to realize when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft, you know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle. And on comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke, recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And Mike, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it, you know, inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much treatment, cinematic treatment, of the events in Grenada. So to have a, you know, a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, you know, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, and would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.